But this house is also a complex mechanism. It's not a child's house. It's a grandly complex with a series of rooms organized along a rather stately axis of movement that runs up through the plan. The house opens on courtyards on the side to take advantage of light and view across Oyster Bay. And it is double height, and it's a framework for the life of the inhabitants and for certain kinds of art. And it is a use of the classical architecture at the kind of big, simple scale that Jefferson also, that I learned from Jefferson, that sort of mad simplicity of Jefferson's classical architecture that gives the house a super scale in relationship to the fundamental trivialities of daily domestic life. The living room opens out to the view, the shape of the vaulted ceiling, the classical moldings and the sense of pilasters and columns model the space, create bays, and mold the light as it comes in, so it becomes a positive vessel for activities and objects. And it opens up its grander facade of brick, gives way on the side to this courtyard plan and the use of shingles and a lighter, more delicate, and fundamentally vernacular touch as it drifts out into nature. Other places have strange architectural traditions. We recently completed a house that's been recently published on a town on the Jersey Shore, New Jersey Shore, a town that has had a horrible infusion of ranch burgers, as you can see in the right, but still has some grand and magnificent sites facing the sea. It's a town that in the 1900s, for reasons that are not totally clear, but nonetheless happened, had a vision of itself as a Mediterranean town. It said, we're by the sea, we will create a kind, the architects must have said, we'll create a kind of resort, seaside Mediterranean architecture. And this house tries to pick up on it. It sits next to the sea, as I showed you. It sits at the back of its lot. A pool becomes a reflecting pool, and then there's a little way down to the water. I tried to create a great room across the end of the house, as though it had been a loggia in a little casino, which, as the Renaissance would call it, a little outbuilding in a garden in the 16th century. And then I enclosed the loggia with glass to make it usable for our days. Now, that town, as I said, had a wonderful tradition of Mediterranean architecture, and it abounded in wonderful houses like this, which is a stone's throw away from where my project is. But in the 1950s and 60s, as new land opened up, architects were called upon by their clients to produce new houses, and either they had no idea of what to do, or they had the wrong idea of what to do. I am convinced that the owner of this house actually wanted a Mediterranean villa from his architect. But his architect probably said, oh, that's not modern. We can't do that. You know, Mies is doing this, and Frank Lloyd Wright's doing that, and so forth. And so, you know, we may have done some really snappy design. The client said, no, 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 you don't understand. I want this and that. And this is what came out. Now, maybe the architect was just bad, which is fairly likely. And maybe he was high-minded and wrong-headed, or whatever. But architects have spent so long saying that the history of architecture before they got born was irrelevant, that or just the subject, fit subject for a slide collection created on a trip to Europe, that I think we have as a culture to do a lot of quick homework onto how to do it. And I tried to make that point before. In any case, in this house, I had to work in a vocabulary I had never thought about before in any detail. But it's not that hard. And you have to dig in and take it as a problem of scholarship and a problem of, if you will, of the pride of making something that fits into this bloody place. And so this house, you enter through a very solidly conceived, articulated doorway. You penetrate into a vestibule shaped to encompass you, put you on the stage as the arriving guest, modeled in three dimensions. You proceed a bit further. If you're welcome, you're allowed perhaps to go upstairs or to move into the house. Every element of it is a rethought from the past. It's not to copy the past, but to rethink the past. And you go into the Vosges room. If you were to go upstairs, you could be on that balcony behind that wall of glass. Look across that loggia out to the sea. That ordinary Esther Williams-type swimming pool becomes a reflecting pool. The ubiquitous jacuzzi at the end becomes an object to focus your eye at the distant ocean. From an upper bedroom, windows open up in French balconies. You stand there. The rooms become kind of balconies in and of themselves to the seas, a little pavilion on the side, and the house then sits along the lawn, open to the sea. That low roof, which I borrowed from Frank Lloyd Wright's Winslow House as much as anything else, he too explored the themes of the Mediterranean villa in his early work. The interaction of the wall of glass and the traditional articulation of the classical orders and that most beautiful of shapes, the Venetian or Cerulean window, I think come together in a new old way, which I feel is fundamental to what American architecture has always been about. Now, I also recently did a little house which is intended to correct all the evils of speculative building in America. Builder Magazine asked me to do a house. Usually the houses are jacuzzis with garages attached to them. And I really said to them, you're not serious. You don't really want me to do a house. I said, you know, I do houses with rooms in them. And we have walls and we have front doors and nobody goes on the shoot to shoot from the bedroom to the kitchen and 100 things like that. They said, no, America has to rethink it. And the editor of Builder Magazine in front of 25,000 or some ridiculous number like that of builders said, forget everything we've ever told you. You have to do it this way. I don't know whether this is true, but this was built in a town called, of all places, Grand Prairie, Texas, and it's a big prairie. I haven't sure about the grand part yet. And in a development called Westchester, because you have to have a little class in Grand Prairie. Grand Prairie is one of those fabulous places that's between Houston, Dallas and Fort Worth, but near the airport. It's a typical American place, and it's a new pioneer. We are the new pioneers, and I tried to make a house that would suggest that it was in Texas and in the American South, basically, and related to a tradition, a tradition, not the tradition, that had evolved. It's brick, it's painted white, it has a tin roof, it has a fairly clear plan, it has real rooms, as I suggested to the readers of Builder Magazine. It has the new American home, which this is called, is the old American home with better plumbing. And that's really what it is. And that's what it, in my opinion, must be. And here you see it as it sits on its little house on the prairie site, soon to be surrounded by other suburban houses. And it is a new building, but it is not just a big object dumped on the site, on its very tight site. It looks as though it's grown over time. It articulates outside spaces as well as inside spaces, and I believe shows that it is possible to work even within this context and make architecture period. So we come in another way to Jefferson, who is and should be the guiding light of all American architecture, it seems to me. Frank Lloyd Wright understood that perfectly. He admired and probably sought to rival in some ways Jefferson, although he never, at least in his writings, ever commented particularly on Jefferson. In any case, the University of Virginia, the place I've explained my admiration for you to, therefore becomes an extremely challenging site when you're invited, when I was invited, to participate in its programs as an architect. Having received my invitation, I was sent into literature by the university, which tells you about the 125-year-old tradition of the Jeffersonian architecture at this great university. It forgets conveniently to tell you about the last 25 years, the 25 years on Happy Roads College sat out. Here is a dormitory for freshmen built somewhere in the 1950s at the University of Virginia. Aside from the fact that it looks like the Howard Johnsons, the freshmen's probably stayed in on their way to the university, as a work of architecture in and of itself, it's preposterous. Not only is the brick a different color from Jefferson's out of the sheer will of the architect, it has no sense of the traditional forms except the very vestigial memory of a gabled end, why that gable end has no windows in it, it beats me. What are they hiding there? Why there's a parking lot right in front of the building when the freshmen aren't allowed to have cars is another mystery. And how you could get into the building through that funny brown door is also quite strange, which of course doesn't lead to the building at all, but to the electrical closet for the building. And as to why you need the same kind of concrete construction that you'd span Lake Pontchartrain with to make the balconies there is yet another thing. Jefferson could do it with 2x4s and a little brick, and this building has to look like it was ready for a launching or something. It is a completely out of control architecture, and we don't even know it. But it's totally meaningless. It's architecture for nowhere, at no time, and has nothing to do with any particular place, and therefore grossly insensitive. Now, there's a reason for that, in part. It's not one architect who is bad. It's the culture. And it was the culture in part encouraged by the architects, who, on the faculty of the university, see, the reason Rhodes College could get away with it, it has no architecture school. Architects confuse things as much as simplify them. If there had been architects at Rhodes College somewhere around 1950, they'd say, "We, Mr. President, we've got to go modern. We've got to be like Harvard. We have to have tack to come and build buildings for us." But instead, they stuck with that old nice Gothic, and that was safe. But if you were the University of Virginia and the faculty wanted to be, an architecture wanted to be important, they said, "Look at these buildings. They're terrible." They weren't terrible at all. They just weren't looking fashionable in the 50s. So they stopped building dormitories like this. And in fact, we were invited, as the first project we did, which is a little warm-up, was to do a dormitory complex on the very site that you see here, next to the last Georgian dormitories, or virtually the last ones that were built. Now, dormitories are the death knell of all architecture. You know, no money, your students trash the buildings even before they get into them, it seems. And we know all about it. But in any case, based on my experience, my interpretation of Jefferson, his idea of a village, of breaking down the large number of buildings to small buildings, and maximizing the individuality of the student and the faculty, based on my experience at Yale, where there was a quadrangle system and colleges and individual doors, I took the 100 students, put them into 2 buildings, I divided the buildings with a courtyard, I let everybody go into the courtyard and then into their individual entryways, so suddenly the students were not in groups of hundreds or even in 50s, 2 buildings, but in 4 entries of 25. Nothing very remarkable in any of this, just common sense and a reconsideration of what had gone before and saying what was there before made sense. And the buildings, as they were built, very simple concrete block buildings sheathed in the local brick, the same color as Mr. Jefferson, slate, or you couldn't afford slate, but something that looks pretty good. And then we came to the roof. Every Jeffersonian building has a chimney. There are no fireplaces in our building, but there are air conditioners. So our air conditioning cooling equipment is the ventilator of the 20th century. The form doesn't change, the function changes. Why, if the function changes, should the form change? That's not absolutely clear in architecture. In any case, the buildings sit there, and many people I know, friends of mine, said, "I've gone to UVA, I've looked for your buildings, I couldn't find them." That's great. It's not my university, it's Mr. Jefferson's university. I could never outclass Mr. Jefferson, certainly not so close to the lawn as this. It's the point is that I know enough when to shut up. You may not think that tonight, but it is true. And here you see the new buildings and the old buildings together, and the problem is, and I don't usually talk about the money that my buildings cost, especially when there isn't enough, but I will say, we didn't have enough money, because when we stopped building buildings like the one on the right, we said, the argument that architects offered was that we could build it cheaper by throwing out all that ornament, all those materials, and of course, then less became the goal. And trustees love that more than anything else. Businessmen love that. If you can tell them they can have the keys to artistic heaven and it will cost them less, they are happier. So we have got to tell them, no, it's now going to cost more to go back to artistic heaven. And we are still in that battle. But the real challenge at the university was this building, which is the real reason I was asked to work there. This building went with, it came in the set that the dormitory I showed you at the beginning came in. This is the dining hall that went with the set. It was the Howard Johnson's restaurant that went with the Howard Johnson's Motor Inn. And a more dismal building, I think it's hard to imagine under any circumstances. It has nothing to do with ideology, it's just a bad building in my opinion. And that mean, inhospitable crevice is the access through which 600 freshmen dine every hour, three times a day, all those lucky devils. They had to add more room to it. This is the inside of the room, in case you had any doubt about my Howard Johnson's reference. It's pretty accurate. And the furniture you'll be happy to know in the University of Virginia, because it's a state university, is built by the prisoners of the State University of Virginia, who become quite adept at running machines, as you can see, and cranking out really ghastly things. So this was the assignment, to add 200 seats to this facility, and to, unofficially, see if we couldn't cover it up. And I think it's a tremendous dilemma. You see, the international style, which we're talking about, wanted to throw away all the past. But if I come here, architects like me, Venturi, Michael Graves, whoever might be giving a talk to you, and said we must throw away the international style, we will be guilty of the same insensitivity, since architecture and culture is not a matter of Monday morning revolutions, but evolutions. So the point is how to bring that old new building, which is only 10 years old, how to bring it into a grander conception. So I saw my job as camouflage, as masking, but not as erasing. Like somebody doing a very good makeup job in a way. You still get the features, but they have been improved. And so our new face for a building that fundamentally had a hideous face, I hope you've given it a beautiful face, and a face that belongs to this place, to this campus. As you can see, we not only added the two wings on either side of the existing building, but I put back all the columns on the inside of the building that the previous architect thought were so wonderful to take out, because he'd made this gigantic barn. It would be like having 400 students eating in a room like this. This room works wonderfully if we're all facing one way and there's a focus, but if you all had people dragging around with trays and you're trying to find your friend in a room this size, it's nowhere. You need discreet bays of space. So I put back, here's what he had, just a sea of this exquisite food and beautifully coiffed freshmen wandering around. And I put back all the columns he'd taken away. I defined the space in 20-foot grids. I had the columns hold up in a tablature or cornice. I put the lighting mostly behind it. I got rid of all the junk on the ceiling. I said, okay, if the prisoners can build metal furniture, we'll fox them. We'll request wooden furniture, which they don't do. And so we were able to get these chairs, which have been made steadily since the 19th century. They're very cheap. They're cheaper, it turns out, than the ones the prisoners make, which is the way you solve that problem. And then the outside, the great new porches, which wrap along. This was the facade of the building. The architect hadn't quite figured out what happened when we went downhill, so he hid some people down there. They happened to be the people who get parking tickets on the campus. If you get mad at them, you can kick them. Just stand outside and kick in. Architects are cool when they want to be. And so I shaded them and sheltered them behind. I put this porch out, this loggia, the organization of the loggia, the detailing is careful. And according to classical precedent and a careful molding of the bricks and so forth, just as Jefferson might have done it. Not how he did do it, how he might have done it. I articulated the spaces into individual pavilions, each defined by a hipped roof with light coming from above, just as I had been taught by Louis Kahn, who was one of the first architects of recent years to return to the classical way of composing buildings, if not necessarily the classical way of detailing them. Here you see these individual bays of space lit from above, which is an ever-changing phenomenon. The wall of glass is also a wall of steel, and the building is technologically as advanced as any other on the campus. Behind this was the idea of Jefferson, his range of buildings, and the pavilion number 9, the only pavilion that I did not mention in a way in talking about the university, because while every other pavilion on the on the lawn is modeled after a classical temple, one from antiquity. Jefferson reserved one pavilion for an inventive modern classical design. This pavilion number 9, which he worked on with Latrobe, and which is the one that seems to say, to speak for Jefferson in saying classical architecture is not a matter of a closed system of composition, but a new order that can go on as well. But to change the slides, I'll show you one more thing and I'll let you go home for breakfast. Sorry, normally I use 2 slides at a time, but through a glitch in the system, which is really my fault, I didn't get the signal right, so it drags out a bit more. You'll have to take it out when we pass the plate at the end. So reduce your contribution. Can you advance it? Should I? Tell me what to do. Okay. And so you see that, if you can remember from the last slide, that idea of the individual pavilion with the light from above, the hip roof, which is a very, very Jeffersonian form, so that this building belongs to the place. Even the Jeffersonian Chinese lattice railings are here restudied in wood. And believe it or not, behind those railings, those windows open as French doors, and this building can be ventilated in the nice, mild spring and fall, which Charlottesville has. These old forms are not used just as a pastiche. They cannot be. They have to be used for what they are. And at night, I'm very fond of buildings that look as good at night, or at least I think so, in the day. In fact, they might even make you want to eat here, which is a great feat in a freshman dining hall, if I must say so. We haven't improved the cuisine, I'm told, but we have made it more palatable, if that isn't a contradiction in terms. Finally, the last thing is, I've alluded at the beginning of this talk to the theme, the fundamental theme, I suppose, in a way, of American architecture and American life, that this continent, even to this day, is an unsettled place. There's no place in the world where cities expand at the rate we do, where we make new cities, where we can invent a place called Grand Prairie between two cities next to an airport, and within 5 years have 50,000 people living in it. We do that every day. We are continuing the pioneering of the original settlement pattern. We are re-pioneering the country. There's also no place in the world as beautiful as the United States, or even far uglier than the United States, has been made so horrible by man. We have ruined as much as we have embellished our continent. There's no point in beating our chest in pride or beating our chest in regret. It's a fact. Now, this project that I'm about to show you is the first project that I've completed that's outside the realm of either institutional or individual houses. It's beyond the realm where a single person theoretically can say, I'll do it no matter what. Or a university can say, we're hopelessly embarrassed, and besides, we can't attract students to these ugly buildings. We've got to do something. This is in the corporate world. This is a site for an office building. But the client is a remarkable client named Gerald Hines. Some of you may know who he is, who is one of the most successful office building developers in the country, but who actually believes that architecture can make the difference between a successful building and a really successful building, one that is lucrative to him, and also, therefore, a source of pride to the people who use the building. And when Gerald Hines called me and asked me if I would do an office building, of course I had a vision of something at least 60 stories high, downtown, some major city. But that wasn't quite what he had in mind. He had a warm-up cruise more in mind for me, which was for, he said, I want you to do a building in Boston. Well, I thought only 30 stories. And he said, well, suburban Boston. He said, actually, only 5 stories. And he said, it's a site that's very interesting. He said, it's next to the off-ramp of the Massachusetts Turnpike. Next to the Toll Plaza, to be exact. And that is the site, as I found it. There is the Toll Plaza, probably the single most hated moment in every commuter's daily trip, because he has to pay going and coming both ways. And he has to wait about 20 minutes in rush hour to pay homage to the state authority. Plus the site, as you can see on the left, was not exactly what you call leafy suburban wonder. It was the detritus of two stages of American development. You know, America, first we tore down all the trees to farm New England. And then we ruined it and turned them into tank farms. After we got rid of them as being farms, and farming didn't work, we turned a lot of our sites into these industrial wastelands. And this was a motor truck terminal next to the highway, I suppose, just where it should be, in Framingham, Massachusetts. And it was a pretty bleak site, but following the great admonition of H.H. Richardson, the American architect who said they were the greatest 19th century architect and the first one admired by Europeans, he said, there are three rules in architecture: get the job, get the job, and get the job, which go with the three rules of real estate: location, location, and location. Well, here we had this very hot location. I already had the job, so who was I to complain? The question is, what do you do here? And I think, in the back of my mind, though no conscious way, was the same problem as how do you begin again? Because there's nothing. Nothing. Just like how you build the first office building in America, or the first this and that. There was nothing here to relate to. No street, no place, no architecture, no beautiful landscape, nothing. I turned back, I suppose, as my inclinations in education would lead me, to the classical past, to the idea of a palace that would command the site, to be a palace of work, to have a great entrance, a great garden leading up, or forecourt, and to try to deal with the cars, which would be ubiquitous, on the site. Actually, Hines wanted to make a stone building, but it proved too expensive. And rather than just wrap the stone, as architects are now wont to do, in eighth-inch slathers all around the building, using it as though it were glass, I said, let us use glass for itself, color it, make it suggestive of the banding of masonry, but then let's have some real masonry at the front where people can enjoy its power and qualities, make a wonderful room inside that's a lobby, and so on. So this was the model of the scheme, a garden, a kind of French garden, if you will, where the trees form great parterres and the cars tack up and down regular rows in a disciplined way. Now, the box of the building is the box of any suburban building. It's as simple and efficient as I know how to make it, and has the usual ingredients, so that the function of the building in the routine way cannot influence the form. Similarly, the structure can influence the form. Mies van der Rohe may have found things of poetry in the steel frame, but certainly the steel frame of a five-story high building with the usual 20 or 30-foot spans is hardly a subject of great poetic interest at this point in history. It's just the way we build. It's just the vernacular of our technology. So clearly that could not be the source of architecture of this typical suburban American town. I had once designed a hypothetical skyscraper in which I had suggested that the tall building was not an extrusion. It was not something that was not some giant salami that was just filled up with slices of office workers. It was a building with a base and a top, as it had been in the 1920s, in the so-called glory days of the skyscraper, but that glass could be used to create certain effects similar to stone, that the tall building could evoke the classical column. The tall building was an analogy for the column, that the glass could help that evocation, and that the tall building could be as proud today and as soaring a thing as Sullivan had predicted in the 19th century, or as Cass Gilbert or Raymond Hood had made it in the 20s, when our tall buildings were cathedrals of commerce. In any case, this is what we did. We wrapped it in glass. We made the building a striped palace, if you will, strong articulation as the building met the sky and corner towers, a great frontispiece, so everyone who comes, visitor and worker alike, feels that he's going to some great palace to visit the king. The king may be the boss, or maybe he's the king. Every man is a king when he has his own PC. He goes to the desk. But it's something, it's there, it is part of, it is talking to you about other experiences you've had. It's not just saying, Walter Mitty, another day at the dreary old place in the dreary old world. Can't you wait to get out of here and go bowling. It is more than that. And the interesting part of this building, and I am proud of this building, is that it's gotten all of Boston insane. 50% of the people hate it, 50% of the people like it, but all of them write to the Boston Globe regularly. And, I mean, here it is, an office building in the midst of this horror, and people are talking and thinking and passionately experiencing it. And they are, in some mad way, people identify themselves. You get off at the Framingham exit, next to Miss Piggy's Pink Palace, they say. Fabulous! And that's what it is about. The building has a balcony at the back where the upper floors can enjoy views over the toll plaza to the distant hills, and where, when the client asked me why I had done this, I said, well, that was so when the Pope came to Boston to bless the lifting of the tolls, which would surely be the most important event in the state of Massachusetts. And everybody in Boston knows that instantly, and there was never a problem about that.